there probably will be mail delivery, offload and reload, and get it to the post office, which is surrounded by water, by the way.
Residents of Queefluck deal with spring floods. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Arctic Ocean drilling opponents protest Shell's plans in front of the White House.
I realize that we have, you know, fuel shortage and everything like that, but look for it on land first.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Breakup has been harder on the lower Kuskokwim than the upper river this year. 15 miles upriver of Bethel, the village of Queefluck, is flooding in all low-lying areas. 31 elderly and chronic care patients were evacuated to Bethel before waters closed off the airport road. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The village sits on the Queefluck River, which is a main tributary of the lower Kuskokwim River. But now, the steep riverbank has all but disappeared, and the surrounding landscape has been flattened by floodwater. Several roadways in town are underwater, and many buildings, including the city office and washateria, are surrounded in water. The local city council has declared a state of disaster in the community. David Epchuk is Queefluck city manager and the commander of the incident management team.
We've restricted traffic on the roads to only essential traffic for emergency services that we'll be providing.
Even with the flooding, things could be a lot worse in Queefluck if it was like 2009 when floodwaters rose in just a few hours. This year, the Kuskokwim breakup has been slow, and residents knew about the potential for flooding a few days before high water set in. Epchuk says he expects at least minor flooding to last for several more days.
There probably will be mail delivery, except as the road breaks, they have to offload and reload and get it to the post office, which is surrounded by water, by the way.
This year, people are a lot more organized than they ever had been.
That's Peter Atchak, who has been a Bethel Search and Rescue volunteer for over 30 years.
That's what we've been dreaming for the last quite some number of years, and it's finally happening that agencies are stepping forward.
Atchak says the slow breakup, combined with an improved effort by local organizations, has given communities along the river the chance to prepare for breakup flooding this year. State, federal, regional, and tribal groups have been meeting regularly over the past week to stay informed about the breakup progress. The nonprofit regional organization, the Association of Village Council Presidents, organized housing in Bethel for evacuees. The American Red Cross is in Bethel meeting with individuals today. The State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management is asking that all donations go through either AVCP or the Red Cross. Next up for possible flooding is Bethel. As the breakup front continues to move downriver, low-lying areas in Bethel are already flooding, and it's expected to worsen over the next 24 hours. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Activists in Washington, D.C. are urging President Barack Obama to stop Shell Oil from drilling exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, they organized a small protest at the White House today.
For just a few hours, the clouds peeled back and the rain stopped. Enough time for a few dozen environmental activists to gather outside the White House. The small event was sponsored by a group of familiar organizations, from the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth to the Alaska Wilderness League. Each group has its own goals and missions. The message today is coordinated.
Now! No drilling!
Willard Notcook is in Washington, all the way from the North Slope village of Point Lay. He says the proposed sites for Shell's exploratory wells are just 60 to 70 miles off the coast from where he lives. He admits some in the community will welcome the boost to the economy from the offshore drilling. He does not. He thinks oil companies need to stick to drilling onshore.
I realize that we have, you know, fuel shortage and everything like that, but look for it on land first.
As a member of the Eskimo Walrus Commission, Nakuk says he's worried about the safety of the animal people in Point Lay rely on for food. George Edwardson worries about the jobs, or more specifically, what the president of the Inupit community of the Arctic Slope sees as the false promise of work.
You'll be lucky if you can find 100 people in Prudhoe Bay from our region. The number's never gone over that. They've got their own people they bring up. And then they talk about unemployment and bringing employment to Alaska. It's a low over 48 that profits and gains from it.
Drilling in the Arctic could begin this summer. Many of the activists contend Shell Oil does not have an appropriate plan to clean up a potential spill. For its part, the company insists it adheres to high environmental standards. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The native village of Chicoloon, the Center for Biological Diversity, and two other groups are suing the National Marine Fisheries Service, claiming the federal agency's permit for oil exploration will hurt endangered beluga whales in Cook Inlet. The groups say NIMFS improperly granted the permit to Apache Alaska Corporation for seismic exploration. A survey last June counted 284 whales. NIMFS spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says the agency can't comment on pending litigation. Alaska's senior U.S. senator was successful today, inserting additional funding for veterans in legislation being considered in the Senate. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Alaska's congressional delegation has long been very supportive of veterans' initiatives, and that support manifested itself once again on Tuesday when Senator Lisa Murkowski was able to include millions of dollars into the fiscal year 2013 Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill. Murkowski spoke about a new initiative for the VA to partner with the Indian Health Service to help veterans in rural Alaska receive health care closer to home.
Many, many times, far too often than not, a veteran in Alaska is required to travel 1,000 miles plus to Seattle or outside of Seattle for a level of care that is able to be provided, whether it's orthopedic services. If the veteran has cancer and needs chemotherapy, they were sent outside for a 5 or 6 week chemo treatment when it can be provided within the state.
Earlier this month, the VA announced that agreements had been signed with 14 Alaska Native tribal health programs to provide care to veterans. The FY 2013 Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill also calls for a study to be done to determine the exact reasons and difficulties that lead veterans being sent to the lower 48 states for medical care. The bill was passed by the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee for Military Construction, Veterans Affairs, and Related Agencies, and now heads to the full Senate Appropriations Committee for their consideration. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Pebble Mine is being prepared for permitting later this year. Mining company Northern Dynasty Minerals Limited announced today that $107 million has been approved to prepare the mine in southwest Alaska for permitting, with the process beginning in the fall. Pebble is a huge copper and gold deposit that sits near some of the world's last and best wild salmon-producing rivers. Supporters say the project will provide good jobs for years. But opponents say the mine poses an unacceptable danger to salmon, the region's valuable renewable resource. Northern Dynasty President and CEO Ronald Thiessen said meetings will be held with stakeholders in the fall. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to revive glass recycling in Anchorage.
You'll find bottles of just about everything. There's a Kirkland tequila bottle and a organic juice jugs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Public hearings are continuing this week on the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, or JPARC's, plan to modernize and enhance training areas in the state. Last night, 24 people attended a hearing at the Palmer Train Depot. JPARC wants to increase the size of one of its military operations areas to within about 40 miles of Wasilla. A new training area could also be added to the north and east of Lake Louise. Flight training could take place between 500 feet above the ground to 18,000 feet. JPARC officials argue the plans will increase the flight training airspace and add live fire areas in the Gulf of Alaska and the Big Delta area to allow for more realistic and efficient training. They contend expanding training areas close to the Anchorage and Fairbanks military bases will save fuel. But no one in Palmer testified in favor of the proposals. Jim Stalker is a pilot and guide who lives in the valley. He summed up one of the biggest concerns.
That's the playground for Alaskans right there. And for somebody in Washington to come down and want to put a military operation right over top of it is absolutely ludicrous. I cannot believe that somebody would be so arrogant to do that.
The JPARC team will be holding hearings in the affected communities this week and next. Public comments will be accepted in writing also. The comment period ends June 7th. Long before climate change dominated headlines, Alaska Native elders noticed that major shifts were taking place in their environment. It is not surprising that people living in remote places, depending on wild fish and game, should have a sophisticated and intimate knowledge of the weather and its impacts on the wild food they depend on. But the elders went farther. 40 years ago, elders advised the young to prepare for hard times. Johanna Urich spoke with some who listened.
It was the 70s, and Larry McCooliff was living in his hometown in the Pribilof Islands. Elders started pointing out things that were not right.
One day an elder came into my office with a fur seal pelt that had the fat fleshed off of it. And he said, take a look at this. And he showed it towards the light, and you can actually see light through it. And he says, shook his head. He says, something's wrong. This shouldn't be.
As wildlife declines mounted, Merkuliev got the elders together, creating a native think tank in the 80s. Meeting four times a year for 4 years, the Council of Bering Sea Elders discussions outlined things that scientists are just now beginning to confirm. Among the concerns elders raised were drying lakes as permafrost melted, allowing the water to seep deeper into the ground.
And if you fly over Alaska, you will see lakes having bathtub rings.
30 years ago, they worried that more beavers building dams, creating slower, shallower rivers, meant the water would get too warm for salmon eggs.
And it was only recently, I think it was last year, that scientists have concluded it's gotten to the point at the peak where 40% of the time the temperature of the Kenai River is too high for salmon eggs to survive.
The elders advise going back to ancient knowledge to get through the predicted hard times. They talked about the ancient information networks that existed along trade routes linking North and South America.
Which is very interesting to me, because they're talking about a long time ago, we don't know when.
Many of the elders Merkuliev listened to are now gone, and he's fast becoming an elder himself. But the idea of a network of natives sharing information has taken form. Natives from Siberia shared work they did to protect walruses hauled out near their village when ice retreated. When the same thing happened on the Alaska side of the Chukchi Sea, Inuit in Point Lay were ready. They took actions to protect the tens of thousands of walruses hauling out near them. Willard Neacock from Point Lay manages the haul-out, rerouting travel to reduce noise, preventing walruses from stampeding and killing each other, something neither state or federal officials had the resources to do.
We want to protect animals that we harvest, so, you know, we won't have to be blamed in case they stampede or get spooked by planes or boats.
Working with state and federal officials, Point Lay rerouted barge traffic to keep from disturbing the animals, and also convinced the Federal Aviation Administration to put flight restrictions over the haul-out. Villagers have changed their own boating patterns to avoid disturbing the animals. Meanwhile, on St. Lawrence Island, the communities of Gamble and Savunga are working to reinstate an antique ordinance, setting their own catch limits and other protections for the island's marine mammals. Perry Pingawi.
We need to have something that's of our own, that was made by our elders in the past, that is working. We all agreed to follow this ordinance, so it might benefit us in the long run.
Larry Mikuliev is studying how villages are taking control. He says natives know they can't wait for scientists or government. Change is happening so fast, it's leaving both behind.
It changes almost monthly now. Changes are so rapid. But yet people in the urban setting seem to be complacent. The native people know now, I think, that they can't depend upon anybody else except themselves.
Many scientists are also now turning to natives for help in understanding the changes sweeping the world. As one said to me recently, climate change is too big. We need to listen to each other. I'm Johanna Urick.
The Aleutian Islands are soon to be home to some of the world's most cutting-edge architecture. Last week, the International Living Future Institute announced the winners of a contest that challenged architects to design an affordable, net-zero energy home suitable for the region's tough climate. Now, as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the Aleutian Housing Authority is moving forward with plans to turn those designs into reality.
The name of the winning house is Finesco. From the outside, it looks a lot like an old-school diner. The walls are made of dimpled sheet metal, and a solid bank of windows runs the length of one side. But appearance is about where the resemblance ends. In all other respects, the house is the antithesis of old school.
We really took an in-depth look at aerodynamics.
That was architect Nacho Santiago. He designed Finesco with two other architects from Madrid, Spain. He says the biggest factor the team considered was how to make use of the famous Aleutian wind.
The turbines are oriented so they make use of the building's curves. They take advantage of the aerodynamics of the structure. But they'll look like a solid line, like a metal cylinder. It'll fit right in with the sheet metal walls of the building.
Santiago says unlike normal wind turbines, these so-called microturbines are fairly quiet. They'll be the primary source of electricity for the house, with geothermal energy providing heating and power backup. Between the two alternative energies, in theory, the house should be able to operate completely off the grid. And that's in keeping with one of the main goals of the competition, to lower utility bills. Most communities in the Aleutians rely on expensive diesel fuel for power. When Aleutian Housing Authority Director Dan Duane conceived of the competition, he was looking for ways to eliminate that cost. And he hopes he's found it.
We have something that's well beyond conceptual, but is not construction ready.
Duane says the next step is actually getting a construction team together to sit down with Santiago and his colleagues and start hashing out the details. Duane says he thinks the house is really well suited to the windy, wet environment of the Aleutians. But he adds that Finesco isn't the only design he's going to be drawing on for ideas. More than 100 teams submitted entries to the competition.
I'm leaving my options open. I'm looking at some other aspects of other entries.
In fact, Duane is considering building test homes of two or three different designs to see what works best.
While the competition was focused on Atka, I also intend to build one in King Cove and Sandpoint.
He says eventually the goal is to develop a design that can work for the entire region.
You know, this isn't a one-off endeavor. We want a model that's replicable.
Duane isn't wasting any time getting started. He wants to start laying foundations as early as this fall and hopes the first buildings will be done sometime next year. Before that, though, he faces another challenge, getting people used to more generic housing, on board with the idea of living in avant-garde diners. His argument?
You know, you always have to be trying to do something better, and that's what we're trying to do.
Of course, if that doesn't work, the idea of never getting another utility bill again might work as a selling point, too. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The APRN Speaker Series presents NPR's foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff Thursday, May 24th at the Anchorage Museum. While his career has taken him to over 45 countries, Flintoff got his start here in Alaska with the Alaska Public Radio Network as a producer and host of Alaska News Nightly. Hear from Corey Flintoff. Reservations and information for the 7 p.m. lecture and for the 6 p.m. meet and greet at alaskapublic.org. Proceeds benefit the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Compared to just a few years ago, it's easier to recycle in Anchorage. Since 2008, curbside recycling of paper, cardboard, and plastics has spread throughout the municipality. And there are drop-off locations for other things, from construction materials to electronics. But there's one thing that people can't recycle as easily as they once could: glass. KSKA's Daisha Eaton looks into what's holding up glass recycling in Anchorage.
Located in an industrial area off Post Road between Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and downtown, Central Recycling is set to begin recycling glass through a partnership with the municipality of Anchorage.
Imagine just a giant hammer spinning at high speed in a box, and you dump the concrete and the glass in the top of it.
One of the co-owners of Central Recycling, Shane Durand, is describing a crushing machine that sits at the edge of a dusty patch of land covered with piles of other things they recycle, like old tires and concrete. In 2009, the Anchorage business that was recycling glass went under. 2 years later, the municipality awarded Durand's company up to $85,000 in grants to figure out how to recycle glass, do research, and buy the needed equipment. The idea was to create a public-private partnership to bring glass recycling back to Anchorage. Durand's machine is crushing concrete now, but it can also crush glass, which he has piles and piles of just sitting around waiting to be turned into gravel-like products that can be used to build roads and fill around pipes.
You'll find bottles of just about everything. There's a Kirkland tequila bottle and a Yellowtail wine bottle, and there's some, let's see, organic juice jugs.
Durand says he's been working on the project for more than a year, and he'd hoped to be producing products for this year's construction season. But instead, the project has been stalled. And if you ask him why, he'll tell you this.
Right now, we have the equipment to do it. We have the facility to do it. We have a market for the material. Currently, the stumbling block is getting accepted specifications within the municipality for them to allow its use.
Durand says he spent months trying to come up with a formula that would work. Then last week, the municipality's Public Works Department finally approved the use of 10% glass in a roadbed product. But Durand requested 50%. He's skeptical he can make enough money with less. Ron Thompson is the director of the Municipality of Anchorage Public Works Department. He's in charge of making the code and specification changes that can set things in motion. He says 10% recycled glass is the industry standard in roadbeds, and they're worried that using a higher percentage of glass could cause problems.
We looked at the industry standard, what's being used all over the country, and that's what we came up with, from 10 to 15%. We have a lot more moisture, a lot more freezing that goes on here. We need to make sure that the moisture doesn't have a problem underneath our road surfaces, or all the roads that we put in would go away. And there's just not a chance. I don't know if anywhere in the country that we've seen that anybody's approved 50%.
Recycling coordinator for the municipality of Anchorage, Donna Mears, says glass has never been a high priority for Anchorage. She explains that's because glass is not a big percentage of the total waste the city produces.
So the most we've ever recycled here in Anchorage is about 1,500 tons a year. Last year we had, going into the landfill, over 308,000 tons of into the landfill.
Mears says there might need to be a provisional project, say in a parking lot, to test out using a higher percentage of glass before final approval. But she's confident that eventually Anchorage residents will be able to recycle glass this way, because residents want it.
Glass recycling is very apparent to residents, because as we're, you know, in our kitchens and we're cooking and we're, you know, having a drink after dinner, having that glass bottle or that glass jar go into the trash instead of the recycling is very significant.
But don't start saving up your bottles just yet. Mears says you won't likely have a place to drop them off until sometime later this year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
If you use Facebook, you might have noticed your friends giving shout-outs to teachers who made a difference in their lives. This appreciation was part of last week's Teacher Appreciation Week. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez joined a sixth grade class at the Unalaska City School to get the scoop on what makes a good educator, what challenges they face, and how to keep more teachers in the system.
When sixth grade teacher Amber Wood asks her students what they want to be when they grow up, she wants them to put a little bit of extra thought into that question.
You've gone through your profile of what you want in your future career, okay, and then you have a list available to you of what options meet that criteria for your income and your expenses. So you're just going to go through and kind of look at those and see which ones are the most interesting sounding to you, and click on those and look at what you need for schooling experience, what a day in that career looks like.
Her 25 kids get busy doing online searches to find out what careers are available to them, and then they pick something that matches their interests. The project is meant to build both their research and public speaking skills. It's also a real-life exercise that Amber Wood, or Miss Wood to her students, had to go through when she decided to go into education. Before joining the Unalaska City School District last year, she'd worked as an instructor at summer programs for military kids. That's when she got the bug for teaching children.
They're so fun. And they're hilarious. I laugh every day with my kids.
Wood loves her job. Like many teachers, she doesn't work a typical 9-to-5. She makes herself available early in the mornings and late in the afternoons, and she's usually in on Saturdays coming up with creative lesson plans.
I want it to be fun. I get bored, too. I mean, so we like to mix it up. This time you're going to, you know, you're going to make a 3D model. This time you're going to draw a picture. This time you're going to talk with your group and discuss it. Then, you know, then do a write-up.
Her extra work seems to be paying off. The class is studying ancient civilizations right now, and student Jonathan Lee says that he's learning a lot from something called the Mesopotamia game.
The strategic game. It's like there's five groups, and like you get own armies, and you get this ziggurat, and then you move your armies around, taking resources.
What would have been a boring way to teach it?
Books.
Of course, there's plenty of assigned reading, homework, and testing, too. But there are also group projects, PowerPoint presentations, and things like 3D map building, which gave student Tia Guji a better sense of Egypt's geography.
And it was really cool because then you kind of got where everything was. Like, before we started social studies, I had no idea where the Red Sea was next to the Nile.
Wood says that she has an easier time focusing on creative projects for her kids in a state like Alaska, where teaching isn't a political football. Wood hopes that she's setting an example, and that maybe one day some of her students will follow in her footsteps. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Rex Gray in Palmer, Johanna Urich and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, and Stephanie Joyce and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.